I'm going to touch on one verse this morning, which continues our theme of the New City Catechism. It's Romans 13, verse 9. Romans 13, verse 9. As you may or may not know, we've been going through the New City Catechism, which is a question and answer on the Christian faith, understanding Christian doctrine and Christian beliefs. We've gone to the stage where we're exploring the Ten Commandments in chunks rather than one command a week. And this week, it's the really uplifting, well, when people ask me what you're doing, I'm saying, well, we won't murder, won't commit adultery, won't steal. I'm surprised more of you came this week. But Romans 13, verse 9, Paul picks up on this. I won't explain the whole passage because we're looking really at the Exodus passage. But how Paul sums this up in the letter to the Romans is really, really important. He says in verse 9, the commandments, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not covet, and whatever other commands there may be. Notice he doesn't even bother to go through all the Ten Commandments, the rotter, eh? Are summed up in this one command. Love your neighbor as yourself. Isn't it interesting when you get somebody telling you something you already knew? Do you like that? When somebody tells you something clearly that you knew before? Well, you shouldn't really be doing it. Like, yes, I know I shouldn't be doing that. I've heard it before. Maybe wives do it to husbands. Husbands do it to wives. You know, we're rolling. Yes, I know I should have put the car into gear, or I shouldn't. You know, whatever it might be. You've got your own examples. We can feel this way somewhat when we come to the Ten Commandments. Don't murder. Don't commit adultery. Don't steal. It's like textbook 101. Don't do it. You learn it as a child, you know, in Sunday school. You know, it's easy. Don't murder. Well, who of us are going to murder, really? We're not that kind of community. Commit adultery? That's a bit more iffy this day and age. I mean, once upon a time, it was, oh, no. This day and age, well, we'll come on to that. And then do not steal. Well, it's an easy one. Don't take what isn't yours. I learned that as a child, and I knew I mustn't steal. Very easy stuff. So why is it in the Ten Commandments? Because let's face it, the Israelites, when they're receiving this word, do not murder, do not commit adultery, do not steal, they already know it. They already do it. They already know it's wrong to murder. The adultery is still an iffy one, even back then. And do not steal. Why would you steal that which is not yours? So why is God putting them here in these Ten Commandments? Why are they so fundamental to the Bible? Why are they fundamental to the Christian life? What do we need to do with it? So we're going to go through these issues one by one in brief. Then we're going to look at how they apply to the world. So let's get my clicker. So how are these three commandments, first of all, perceived? The first one we have in verse 13. Thank you so much. In verse 13 there is, you shall not murder. Now, murder is an easy one, isn't it? You don't take someone else's life. But for the Israelite, it was a little bit more complicated than that. It wasn't just about, okay, don't kill, full stop, because they had something such as capital punishment. If somebody was caught in a pretty grievous sin, they would be executed. Pretty serious stuff. When they went to war, they killed. Isn't that murder? So this term was restricted, which didn't include capital punishment and military conquest, but it was a just term. So if it isn't in the sense of justice or against an enemy of the people, that's how we're talking. So if you've killed somebody accidentally, it's still murder, but you shan't do it. If you intentionally thought, well, I'm just going to get rid of that person because they're in my way, you shouldn't do it. But if, for example, the person who commits murder, as it's explained in Leviticus, and they admit to it and they're not going to give restitution, then the punishment is death. In fact, in wartime, and we know in the Old Testament, we can't hide from it, there is a lot of killing in the Old Testament. How do we marry that up? Well, we argue that God is just. So anything where a death sentence is carried out has to be in the eyes of justice, in God's eyes, not ours. But we live in a world where any sort of killing is reprehensible. And it would seem that as the Israelites move on into establishing themselves as a nation, God doesn't go and say, now wipe out that nation, that nation, that nation, and conquer the world. In fact, God's quite the opposite by saying, you are a light to these nations. Remember also the nations that they went in to turf out of the promised land were child sacrifices. They would kill each other freely. They would sacrifice children for fertility. They would do all sorts of heinous crimes against each other. Who are we to judge what God has judged? It's not an easy one. And it's one that's going to open up a lot of debate. But here we read, do not murder. In Leviticus, as you unpack the law, even the murderer is given a chance at restitution. God gives the opportunity for someone who commits a crime to have recompense. It's called restitution. But we can say that's harsh. We can say that's not very easy. But let's go to what Jesus says about murder. I'm just going to turn to Matthew chapter 6. You might think Jesus would say the same, wouldn't you? But this is what Jesus says. Sorry, Matthew chapter 5. You have heard it said, do not murder, and anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. But I tell you that anyone who is angry with his brother will be subject to judgment. Listen to that. Anyone who is angry with his brother. In fact, anyone who says to his brother, Raca, which is fool, is answerable to the Sanhedrin. But anyone who says, you fool, will be in danger of the fire of hell. I mean, this is serious stuff. Jesus is even saying anger against somebody is wrong. Anger against another person is wrong. It's as serious as murder. Now, many characters in the Bible murder. In fact, I had one person recently say they had to give up reading the Bible because of the amount of killing in it. And I thought, yeah, I can understand. I can understand that. It's really tough going. We see murder in people's hearts. We see the plotting to kill from Cain and Abel to the arranged murder of Uriah by King David. And if you don't remember who Uriah is, we'll come on to him in a minute. It's a snare in the hearts of men. And if anything, the Bible doesn't glorify killing. And it does not say genocide is a good thing. And it does not support the idea that we as Christians should go out as warriors and conquer nations and kill people. In fact, quite the opposite. God used for a time the people of Israel as his tool of judgment on a nation. And he will use his judgment again on the nations. That is why Jesus says anyone who is angry is in danger of hell. Not because they've committed murder, but because of what goes on in the heart. You see, God is the author of life. And he has the authority to take it. Because he is a just judge. But more than that, anyone who claims to believe and follow God must take this to heart. The heart of any community is a dedication to life and well-being. Listen to what God said before the Ten Commandments, just before in Exodus chapter 19. In Exodus chapter 19, God said this about the people who would come into the land. Here we are, verse 5, chapter 19. Now, if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all the nations you shall be my treasured possession. Although the whole earth is mine, you'll be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. And what they would do, I'm actually in the wrong chapter, I apologize. But in Exodus, God says to look after the foreigner, to bring them in and to bring them as part of your family. So how do we marry up the barbarism we see in the Old Testament with God's love? Well, it actually surely shows the barbarism that we see actually in books like Judges especially is the human heart. We are prone to hate. We are prone to get angry. We are prone to want selfishly and to get rid of other people. You see that quite vividly in the news today, which we'll come on to. The second one is just as hard, isn't it? Adultery. Adultery breaks down families and society. It's a sign of an immoral heart. It destroys integrity and trust. God not only lists adultery as an issue here, but in Leviticus we find he expands it to include laws about all sorts of sexual sin. It's poignant here because God's community are going to take the first steps into being a light to the nations. They're going to show how good and powerful and right God is. That unity between husband and wife is sacred, and it symbolizes God's unity with us. It's not to be despised or joked about or made fun of or made little of. It wasn't precious in that day. As life was cheap, sex was cheap. It is actually one of the first strongest statements regarding sexual unity since the Garden of Eden, when God said of Adam and Eve, go and multiply. And we have that wonderful word where it says, the son shall leave his mother and father and unite with his wife, and they will become one flesh. But Jesus, he goes on to say something else, back to Matthew chapter 5. Jesus goes on to say something else about adultery. He's not finished with murder. He says this, do not commit adultery, but I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully and has already committed adultery in his heart, if your right eye causes you to sin, gouge it out, throw it away. It is better for you to lose one part of your body than for the whole body to be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off, throw it away. It's better to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to go into hell. Men and women, I think, would be walking around blind and possibly without many limbs if we applied that literally. No? But God, Jesus isn't saying here that we should be literally gouging out the eye and literally cutting off arms, but he's saying how serious lust is, how serious sin can be, how serious what goes on in the heart can affect the mind. He's saying here, the very look at someone in the wrong way, you've committed that sin in your heart. King David, in his story, first committed adultery, then followed it by arranged murder. Not only that, he stole Uriah's wife, whom he'd lusted after and killed for. King David was the man who wrote most of our psalms, including The Lord's My Shepherd, which we sang this morning. King David was a man who knew his own sin all too well and was guilty for it. But he's also a man who repented. He's a man who begged God to be merciful towards him because he knew his sin. He didn't give permission for his sin. He got forgiven for his sin. So we'll come on to murder and adultery in a moment and how it affects our world. But then we have that final do not steal. It seems a simple one, doesn't it? The thing is, in the Old Testament and the New Testament, there is an affirmation that there'll always be the poor amongst us. And they're the ones who usually get stolen from first. They're the ones who get undermined when somebody gets... If a rich man gets stolen from, oh well, you know, it's annoying, it's frustrating, but they can probably survive. The poor get stolen from. They have nothing. In another story in the Old Testament, King Ahab, not the sea captain from Moby Dick, but the king from the Bible who really lived, he saw a man's vineyard and decided, I want that vineyard. And the man said, you can't have it, it's mine, it's all I have. And so his wife, a woman called Jezebel, said, you take it. I'll get rid of this guy Naboth. And that's what she did. She got Naboth killed, and he stole Naboth's vineyard. Interestingly, isn't it, that actually Jesus himself picks up on this idea of stealing. In Matthew 23, Jesus gives, it's one of my favorite chapters, Jesus deals with the hypocrisy of the Pharisees and teachers of the law, the people who were meant to protect the people. And one of the things he says is, you're basically taking from people the way of life. You're supposed to be the gatekeepers of the kingdom to show people the way, and then you shut them off from it at the same time. When I read Matthew 23 and I talk about hypocrisy, it hits me very hard. Because Matthew 23, as with these verses about murder and adultery and all the other laws, they're like mirrors shining back at us and showing our own darkness. In fact, we can feel pretty bad about ourselves. It's easier actually for us to pinpoint our crimes against one another. Oh, that person's a real rotter. Oh, did you hear what so-and-so did? Oh, look at that person over there. They're not doing that and that right. Oh, look at this person. They're annoying. They keep taking. They're never giving. But Jesus repeats that if you're not loving your neighbor, if you're not loving this person whom you're saying, oh, look at this person, if you're not loving them, you are a hypocrite. The grace of God does not give us permission to sin and to judge others. The grace of God is a rescue from sinning. Do you remember how the Ten Commandments started? Anybody want to give it a go? How did the Ten Commandments start? You shall love the Lord your God. Not quite. That is the main commandment, but that's all right. It's a good one. That is the summed up. That is the commandment summed up. But Exodus chapter 20. It's all right. Thank you, Edna. Yes, I am the Lord your God. I brought you out of the land of Egypt and out of slavery. God is the one who has rescued his people. He's establishing for himself a community to rescue others. Now imagine this community going into a community in the promised land of murderers, of adulterers, of people who stole, who took the lives of children and sacrificed them to Molech. Imagine them going to a land where they worshipped a pantheon of other gods and goddesses and prostituted themselves to each other and shrine prostitutes. Imagine a world like that. Do you think that community would survive? God brought judgment on that community in a way we don't like, but it was his to judge. But from that was not supposed to be a murderous, adulterous, or stealing nation, but a nation that would come out and be just, be God-glorifying, be loving to their neighbor. As Paul says in Romans 13, the summed up of the commands are love your neighbor as yourself. And as Karen put it, the first command, the greatest command, love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, and soul. So these are the three commands. Again, they're not just judicial. They're not just legal. They've got an element of speaking to our heart. So let's have a look at the real world. And this is a very brief, because we don't really need to look at the world to see where these things are, do we? Let's take murder. What we got. Right, we look at the newspaper. Oh, we've got a very sad looking Theresa May there. What else have we got here? BBC investigated over pay discrimination against women. Could we say that's stealing? Maybe. Maybe it's an attitude of, well, they're only women, aren't they? I mean, ladies, you should get paid less, right? No? No? Crazy. What we got here? Let's see what else. I should have had a look at this before, maybe. Here we go. PM on borrowed time. Anything about New Zealand in here? I was really hoping for an article on New Zealand. Nothing on New Zealand. Typical. It's been on all week, and then they choose the one day I look at the paper. New Zealand. A man who went in a murder. When did he become a murderer, though? Was it when he shot the gun? By law, yes. By the law of God, when he hated them. When he conceived the idea of picking up a gun or series of guns and shooting those people. That's when he became a murderer in the eyes of God. What about lust, adultery? Does it happen when the man is caught in the act? By law? Yes. But by God's law? When it happens in the heart. When I go, whoa. I've condemned myself. It's the natural thing in the world to do because we live in a Western society where women dress to be provocative. Don't they? Where men dress to accentuate their manly features, although I don't really know why. I mean, you know. But we have a world that says, look at this, don't you want it? This is everything you should desire to have. Believe it or not, the cultures that Israel was going to turf out wanted their shrine prostitution. They wanted their child sacrifice because they really believed it was going to bring them greater numbers, greater power in the world, greater economy. And what about taking selfishly? Stealing. Where do we see that in the world? We don't have to look far to be depressed with the world. But then Jesus starts to say, now look at yourselves, the real me. We would say, I never murder. I would never commit adultery. I would never steal. I think most people here would say that in an instant. I mean, in fact, if we got everybody up and said, you know, do you agree with these three statements? I think pretty much all of you would say yes. One or two I'm a bit suspect on, but yeah, no. No, no. Thanks, Sheila. I'm glad you said that. At the end of the day, when we get up and we say to people, I believe in Jesus, we sort of put ourselves a halo around our heads, don't we? In the eyes of others. And we think, oh, wow, they must be super good and perfect. But we're not. When I say I believe in Jesus, do you know what I'm saying? I'm worthless. I'm a sinner and I need Jesus. I don't need Jesus because I'm good. I don't need Jesus because I am perfect. I don't need Jesus because I don't commit adultery, don't murder, don't steal. Do you know how many people I hate on the road? Do you know how many people I have looked at and I've thought, well, they're looking nice and I've got to guard myself. And I say that in front of my wife and I've got to be humble there. And I have to repent. How many times I have looked at something and said, I really want that. Or I've stolen time. Or I've stolen words. Or I've stolen people's hearts. Not in a good way. Stolen people's hearts. True love does not destroy. True love sacrifices. It says, less of me, more for you. And if we did that together, can you see how we would never lose out? Not one of us would lose out. If we were all looking out for each other. Or it would be like me at college and a friend of mine. We both needed the same room at college for an event. And I said to him, no, you have it. And he said, no, you have it. And I said, no, you have it. That went on for about 3 minutes. The receptionist said, look, stop being so Christian about this. One of you have it. Love one another. No, I just backed off. I said, no, you have it. I slept on a couch. After Jesus teaches on anger, lust, divorce, Jesus surely ties it in to the Beatitudes that came before it all, where he says, bless and do not curse. Love, do not hate. Love those who persecute you. Love those who say, hate you and say all things against you, because that is how they treated the prophets. How do you love someone who is a murderer? How do you forgive someone who does atrocity? How do you show honor to a prostitute or a porn star? How do you love a person whose purpose it is to elicit wickedness and sin? How do you care for that person? The first place we need to come to is real honesty. Confession. Confession is good for the soul, the saying goes. But actually, more than that, it gives us freedom from the hiding place of our thoughts and our hearts. I'm not asking everybody to come up here and say what your darkest secret is. You know what your darkest secret is. But I am saying this. Find a Christian friend who can pray with you and open up about your darkest secrets. Find someone you can be accountable to and say, this is what I'm struggling with. Be honest. If anything you have picked up today, whether it be hate, whether it be lust, whether it be stealing, whether it be anything, or some form of addiction, be honest with somebody and say, I want to deal with this in my life. I want to pray about this. I don't want this in my life anymore. You know what often happens is when we see these extremisms and these terrorist attacks, they're happening in the shadows, in darkness. People can't see it. That's why we need to shed light onto these areas of darkness and say they're real, they're happening. So then police and others can go in and deal with these people. There was an outcry some years ago from police to paedophiles to say, come forward and tell us you're struggling with this. Because paedophilia is one of those areas where we're keeping paedophiles in the dark. We're saying to them, you are so hated, so despised, and understandably so, that you must never come forward and say what your problem is. But their problem with lust is the same problem as the husband who has a problem with pornography. It has to come out. It has to be in the open, and it has to be dealt with. Otherwise, it will destroy. Self-exposure of our sins is like looking in a mirror that we don't want to see. And I know some people say, I've just looked in the mirror and I hate what I look like. For that, you need Jesus. Reality tells us we are not perfect, but the world wants to keep you in the illusion that you can have whatever you want. Paul wrestled with this issue when he exclaimed in Romans as well, I do what I don't want to do, and what I do want to do, I don't do. It's a bit complicated, but you can follow it. But he comes at the end saying, who will save me from this body of death? And if the letter ended there, I'd say we would be very depressed. But then comes the next verse. But thanks be to God for Jesus. Don't know if you were watching Mari as she was doing her sign. She told me something wonderful this morning. Can I tell people what you told me this morning? Is that all right? Come up and show us. She was saying about something very important regarding her sign language. I don't know if you spotted it. Did you want to share about that, or shall I just say what you did and you're going to show them?
No.
I'll say it, you show it.
You say it.
You show it. Okay. Right. To me, to you. Right. When we said thanks be to Jesus, it's not because Jesus comes and just says, all right, I'm just going to, treat you and talk to you and coddle you. What Jesus does is an act of grace. And it was that word grace that Mari did a sign for. That was very poignant. Do you want to show us that word for grace? Yes, God smacked. Grace, because it's God's hand coming down and rescuing. Imagine that for the murderer. Imagine that for the adulterer. Imagine that for the thief. Being told not that, well, you know, what you did didn't matter, because that's not what we're saying. Crimes are crimes and they must be punished. But rather, grace says, I'm going to rescue you from the pit of the miry clay. I'm going to rescue you from the dirt that you have got yourself into. I'm coming to rescue you. With Jesus, we can find honesty. You're a sinner. You're really in it. This is terrible. Forgiveness. But I forgive you because I took your sin upon myself. So what Jesus is saying is, you know that lust problem you've got? It's on me. You know all those people that were murdered? It's on Jesus. You know all those things you stole? It's on me. Go and sin no more. Now that is hard. That is not easy for us to listen to or accept, because in our self-righteousness, there are plenty of evil people out there who deserve to be, you know, dealt with by the hand of the law, including you. All of us have something which God will say, sinner. But when he looks at you, he doesn't see the sin. When he looks at you, he sees Jesus. He sees his son's blood over your sins. He has paid the price, and he will redeem you. So when you are beset by that addiction, when you're beset or you're tempted to look at somebody the wrong way, when you're tempted to hate the driver who's just cut you up, love them. See, Jesus said in Matthew's gospel as well, love your enemies. Love your enemies. You've heard it said, Jesus says, love your neighbor, hate your enemy. But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be sons of your Father in heaven. Do you understand that? Love those who hate you. How do we do that? Only by the grace of Jesus. Only by his mercy. It's not easy what we're asking. You're going to go away and you're going to wrestle with these thoughts this afternoon as you wrestle with whatever you're having for lunch. But I'm asking you, don't trust in your own wisdom to work it out. Trust in the wisdom of Jesus, who by grace went to a cross and said on that cross, the people who are crucifying him, forgive them, Father, for they don't know what they're doing. And Jesus, who died and who rose again, is the one who promises eternal life. Friends, if you deprive yourself of Jesus this morning, you'll be depriving yourself from the water and bread of life. When we read these commands, I urge you to look with the eyes of grace and the eyes of hope and the eyes of restoration. Don't look at your neighbor with anger, but with how they can come to know Jesus. Let me pray.